The Beera Podcast. Research matters.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Beera Podcast. My name is Bukola Oyinloye. I'm a researcher at the University of York and co-convener of the Research Methodology in Education Special Interest Group at Beera. The Special Interest Group is doing a podcast series to showcase different methodologies and methods. For our first episode today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Martin Johnson. Dr. Martin Johnson has worked in education research for over 20 years. He started out as a primary school teacher working in London and Southeast England. Currently, he's a senior researcher at Cambridge University Press and Assessment, where he focuses on the interaction between assessment, learning, and curriculum issues. He has worked on projects across academic and vocational related contexts and investigated assessment issues in diverse sectors such as primary and post-compulsory education. Dr. Johnson is a fellow of the International Society for Design and Development in Education and an executive member of the British Association for International and Comparative Education. His work has involved the use of a variety of qualitative and quantitative research methods, and he won the Research Methodology in Education Special Interest Group Best Paper Award at the 2022 Beera Annual Conference. Today, we'll be discussing his use of the diary method, specifically within the context of a study conducted during the lockdown. Welcome to the podcast, Martin.
Hi, nice to see you, Bukola.
Great. We're really excited to speak with you today. Thank you for being a part of this series. To set us off, can you please provide an overview of the study we'll be discussing on this episode?
Yeah, I mean, exciting days, the pandemic. You know, we was going through a moment of almost like an existential crisis in research. It's like, what do we do when we can't get out to talk with teachers and students and get into schools where actually, you know, real education's happening? And so we really had to interrogate, how do we know what's going on? So what we wanted to do was, we knew there were seismic shifts going on. There were massive changes going on, but we were only hearing about them either secondhand through the news or through personal, you know, friendships with teachers. So we felt it was really important to try and get some firsthand empirical information and data about what was going on in schools, particularly around changes that were inevitably going to happen when schools went through periods of lockdown, reopening. All the relationships within schooling were changing. You know, the teaching and learning relationships were changing. You know, teachers' roles were taking on additional responsibilities. And there was so much around the idea that well-being was obviously going to be affected as well. So, you know, we wanted to think about how we would find out what was going on, but in a non-invasive way, so we weren't going to add any additional burden to the people we were trying to, you know, have an interaction with to try and find out what was going on, so teachers themselves. So what sort of methodology would we use if we were going to try and work out what was changing in terms of the pedagogic relationships, the curriculum, so what was being taught, and also the assessment, which, you know, from the perspective of this department was always, you know, the big thing that people were interested in. But my particular areas of interest were how assessment would then be affecting and working within schooling. So, you know, it was really that. It was just about trying to understand what was changing in terms of pedagogy, curriculum, and assessment during a period of massive upheaval. And the problem was to try and work out how we might do that.
That's really helpful. And I like this idea of trying to find out what's going on in an uninvasive way or non-invasive way. So what methodological approach would you say underpinned this study when you were thinking about trying to do this in this non-invasive way? What was the methodology that you were thinking through?
Well, because, you know, there was waves of being in and out of school, and we weren't in control of any of that. No one was, were they? So, you know, we started planning in September 2019, I think we started thinking about this as a project. Could that be right? No, it must have been 2020. It's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, time just disappears. It's like, where were we? We started in the September when there were lockdowns. But actually, no, the schools were out. The schools were back in over the summer. So the schools were, students were back in school. So we thought we could try and understand through using maybe a diary method to try and get into the sort of practices that people were involved with. And actually, as we followed out, as the project unfolded, you know, we realized the schools were being taken back into lockdown again. So, you know, it was actually, as I say, out of our control. So what we wanted to do was, we knew it would be highly cognitive as an assumption about what we were trying to work out, because we were really working from what the teachers' perspectives were. So, you know, we could, in an ideal world, you could have done an observational study, you could have done a video-based analysis or whatever, but that just wasn't possible because in the lead-up to the planning of the project, there were regulations in place that said you couldn't. You know, we still had social distancing. We would have been most unpopular if we'd have gone into schools and said, hey, how about taking us in as well? And we want us to hang around. So, you know, there was enough going on. So we knew that we would need to base our data on teachers' own perspectives. And so highly cognitive in that sense. So it's what's going on in their mind. But in a sense, I thought that was highly valid because, you know, they are responding to the environment around them. They are changing that environment, but it's all being filtered through their experience and through what they're making of that experience. And as professionals, that's what's really interesting, because it's really trying to find out about their practice, what's influencing their practice, how they're thinking, and what's influencing changes in their practice. So really it was, a diary seemed relevant in that sense. We also needed a methodology that was able to cope with unknown futures. So the idea of, you know, if circumstances change, the methodology isn't, you know, shot to pieces. You know, we needed something that was flexible enough so that it would respond to change. It wouldn't be, you know, yeah, it wouldn't be shattered if things changed significantly within schools, and things like diaries can cope with that. We were really interested in not adding to the well-being burden of teachers. And we felt that if we had a methodology such as diaries, they have quite a degree of control over when and if they wanted to contribute. So when they were going to, you know, be collecting their information and reflecting on that, you know, it wasn't imposed on them. So, you know, a little bit more detail there. We asked them to do a diary once every 2 weeks in terms of a submission. And we said to them, you know, we wouldn't expect anything more than a half an hour a week of reflection time and setting it down. And we set those expectations out quite early because we knew that one of the things that diaries can add to in terms of burden is, if you're uncertain about what someone wants of you, it adds to your burden. It could actually compromise your well-being, because you don't know if you're doing it right and you don't know if you're doing enough. And am I answering the questions you're interested in? And all of those things. So it was really important to get that sort of, you know, established guideline very early on and say, you know, we don't want anything more than that. You can if you want, but actually, you know, it's up to you. It had to be remote. So that was, you know, part of the conditions of the time. So diaries work well with that. So they would submit things electronically to us in terms of like submissions of information. And we'd have prompts, which could change over time. So as I say, you know, it could reflect uncertain futures. You know, we didn't know 6 weeks in advance what issues were going to be very, very relevant. So we could change them like a week in advance and say, actually, can you tell us a bit more about this? And because we worked with the teachers through like an online submission system, it was through some software that they logged into, it meant that they, you know, we could drop things in there and change that over time. So, you know, the reflexiveness was great for that. But as I say, we wanted to really focus on their thinking, what was affecting them, really pandering to the idea of professionals as being able to reflect in their practice and reflect on their practice. So the idea that, you know, they'll be reflecting in the moment, so there's things that you want to capture, but also a part of professionalism is about reflecting on your practice. So it's almost taking a step back afterwards and saying, how did that go? So diaries can work with both of those forms of reflection. So that was quite good. But the big thing is the longitudinal aspect of diaries. So the idea that how sure you are about a reflection is reinforced when it persists over time. So, you know, it has an added power if you've got something which is a patterned behavior and which is re-emerging. But that's not to say things like one-offs are not important, because those contextual features of the everyday are also very good to capture. So, you know, it has all of that. But I think the longitudinal aspect is good because it suggests some practices are sedimented and long-standing and that they have a certain power about them. Yeah, if you see a number of people saying similar things, you have a sense of confidence around very subjective things. You know, it gives you a bit of confidence in that. So those were the sort of real reasons why we use diary, but we also supplemented that with other approaches.
Thank you. Thank you for providing that overview, really detailed and really interesting. There were a couple of things that you said that I wanted to pick up on. You mentioned the well-being element. You wanted a methodology or a method which didn't add to teachers' well-being or which didn't serve as a well-being burden, in the sense that they didn't have to be fearful of not doing things right. But I was wondering whether another element of that well-being element was the potential therapeutic purpose of a diary. This idea that when you're writing things down, or the notion of journaling as helping to process your thoughts, as helping to serve in that therapeutic way. So that's one thing, whether you thought about that potential therapeutic element of the diary as being part of not wanting to add to the well-being burden. And an interesting thing about the longitudinal aspect that you mentioned about this, again, sort of the validity or the trustworthiness, if you will, of something that is repeated over time. And this might be more about the findings, but I was wondering whether, rather than something that's being reinforced over time, whether you were concerned or you were reflective about the possibility of the diary also exposing those differences. So things that maybe had been reflected on in a certain way at one point in time, which then changed over time. And what that presented as a trustworthiness issue, if it did.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, going to the first point about well-being, you know, we were very concerned that, you know, from an ethical point of view, how do you deal with something where there is an unknown and there is a potential that you are confronting, or people are confronting themselves to some extent with difficult feelings. So, you know, we had people talking about, you know, things that were going on in their personal lives, which were affecting their family members, or to students, and you know, who they were teaching, and how difficult it was, and what the students were going through, and we in a sense knew in advance we'd have to have a way of dealing with that. So how do we ethically support people who might be inadvertently helping to confront issues which are problematic? So we'd done that through ensuring that we provided, at a simple level, advice and guidance and places to go, signposts to places to go for additional advice if you were troubled. But also the ultimate buyout, in a sense, was that you could drop. You know, there was no expectation that you'd follow through, even though you'd said you'd be in it throughout the project. And we had 15 teachers in our project from a variety of subject areas in secondary education. So, you know, they could, and they didn't, but they could have dropped at any time, and we wouldn't, you know, there would have been no pressure on people to do that, because we recognize that the other important stuff that they're doing was way more important than this. So I think that was one thing that really we could control to some extent. What I did come across, there was some interesting work by an academic called Brooks. I don't know her first name, in Australia. And this only came through later on while I was thinking through the project. And she'd found in her work around the pandemic that teachers, when they were using diaries or reflective pieces, were actually benefiting from that process during the pandemic because they were unburdening themselves. But there was an important caveat, and I think I recognize this in our data, that if you feel you're burdening someone else by passing it on to them, that's not a good thing, and that doesn't help you. So therefore, you have to have this almost like a safe space to know that who I'm passing it on to isn't going to be worse off by hearing this. So it's that unburdening and responsibility of, you know, who you tell. So I thought, you know, I was interested when we started this, because I thought, who's going to tell us stuff? You know, how personal would you be with people actually you haven't met? You know, it's a remote interaction with researchers. And why would you, you know, why would you divulge things of a personal nature? Diary work we'd done in the past for other projects, going back some, you know, we'd ensure that we'd spend time with our participants, with the teachers, meet them face to face, establish a good relationship. So it was a relationship of trust that, you know, there was no other agenda here. You know, we weren't sort of taking your data, disconnecting it from you, and then using it for our own aims. And I think I worried about this new project during the pandemic because I thought we're not doing that. We haven't got the interpersonal FaceTime, you know, real FaceTime, and our relationship might not be as strong. But I was surprised because actually people were, and I wonder whether it's something to do with the benefits which weren't the forefront of our project, but actually which people were getting out of it. And in the findings, and this was unprompted, I don't know how many of our teachers used the word cathartic. and it was, you know, something that we found in our data that they were saying, actually, I got a lot out of this. Not only was it allowing me to reflect on my own practice, but it was actually transforming my practice because I was then thinking about how do I do this better, but actually feeling better about it because, in a sense, just getting it out of your head and somewhere seemed to be a real benefit. So I think the well-being aspect was captured in that way. And we also used some of the methods, which we can talk about later, which talked, you know, thought about well-being as well, which we captured in a more sort of quantitative way to help us to support the qualitative stuff. But Cole, you talked about change.
That was really helpful. The other part of the question that I had earlier was about this longitudinal aspect of the diary, the point you made about the longitudinal aspect. And you made the point that actually this reinforced certain findings because certain findings were repeated in those diaries over time. And I was wondering about the findings that weren't repeated or the ones
that changed
over time.
Yeah. That's really good. Yeah. So the idea of change over time was fascinating, or non-change. I mean, some of the things which didn't change were aspects of anxiety, uncertainty, you know, those carried through because things are always changing. And to some extent, isn't that a feature of professional practice? You know, we have things which we hold on to and which keep us stable, in a sense, because they're repeated. You know, we have our timetabling and so on, and we have our established relationships, which give us patterns during the week and during the term and during the year. But actually, within that, who knows what's coming through the door? So uncertainty, I think, is an accepted feature of teachers' professional practice anyway. So that's unsurprising that we found that. But the content of that uncertainty was different because there was so much change going on in terms of, say, assessment arrangements. When we started, assessment was very much down to teacher assessment. There'd been an interesting shift that it became more of a teacher's responsibility than a school's responsibility, which was the thing of the year previous to that. So therefore, teachers are feeling much more accumulated responsibility and burden with that. So that was changing. And then as we went through the process, you know, it became the guidelines around that became more clear. But at the start, they were very uncertain. One of the things that did change was the types of things that were being taught over the period. So we were working between January and May of 20. I should know which year. It must have been 2020. But it feels like 2019. It was definitely 2020. But yeah, we found that at the start of the year, teachers were deferring things which were more problematic and difficult to deal with. So high-level concepts, things that were, you just would want to be with your students around to pick up the level of discourse and discussion. So we found during the remote teaching sessions, teachers were saying, you know, discussion was much harder to do. There was much less of that. It was much more didactic. At that time, they would push off the more difficult things and say, we'll deal with those later. And then when schools opened up, you know, for everybody in a sense, not just for key workers, children, then they were really catching up. So they were dealing with all the very difficult things, but also the burden of assessment was becoming closer. So the dates you had to assign your grades and submit them and so on. So there was a real sense of frenetic activity and stress because they were dealing with quite difficult areas of concept, knowledge and education, and time was short. So, you know, you could see that change over time of the sort of slightly more relaxed beginning of the year. It's like, well, we're doing what we can do. But actually when the, you know, schools became much more face-to-face again, even though it was a weird sort of face-to-face, you know, the idea of dealing with face masks and all of that, you know, was a new area of practice again. you know, they had a lot to do in a relatively short time. And that was a real burden. So that was an aspect of, you know, some change that we spotted. And then there was an interesting area of differentiation between different subject areas. So we had teachers of subjects that we felt we'd expect to have challenges around if you move to remote teaching. So things that had practical elements like science or PE, English drama. So things that had sort of, you know, applied skills where you'd want to observe students working or working together and things like that. Interestingly enough, sometimes when people, most of the teachers were reporting overwhelming burdens in terms of workload and saying this is unmanageable, you might get one or two teachers saying, actually, I'm okay at the moment. And when you probed it, you'd say, why, you know, why is that? They said, well, actually, I should be doing outdoor PE lessons at the moment. It should be rugby or something. And the weather's horrible and it's raining. And actually, I don't have to do that. So actually, I can do the other stuff. And so, you know, you got those little interesting, quirky patterns, which were different for different teachers in different subjects at different times of the year. So it just opened the door to some of those things, which was, you know, it's very highly personal and subjective, which was great. It's really important.
That's really useful. I think those nuances around the different periods of the year and the subject level differences is really interesting. You mentioned that you also included other methods. Could you give us a sense of what those were? And also, was it diary supporting those other methods, or were those other methods supporting diary within the context of your study?
Right, yeah. I think a lot of the work we've always done here has always been mixed methods. You know, the idea of actually complementing methods rather than, you know, having ones which was separate and apart and in contrast with each other. So I think what we felt at the time was that, first of all, we needed to establish good relationships with the teacher. So we needed to understand their context. And we couldn't go into a diary approach without some sort of, you know, strong background knowledge of, you know, otherwise, how do you know what questions to ask people? Or how do you start a conversation through a diary? And what sort of prompts might you use? So we used interviews at the very start and at the very end of the period, so in January and in May. And that, so the, like a pre-diary and a post-diary interview. So the first interview was, say, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, again, on Teams or something like that, where we'd ask the teachers to talk about their context, you know, their schools, what had gone on before, you know, in terms of since the start of the pandemic and how that, you know, what changed. So we could get an idea of change in advance and where they were in their practice now. And in a sense, I think what it was giving the teachers more space into the participant relationship with us, in a sense, of giving, you know, space to let us know about themselves. And also to break down some of those trust issues that we might anticipate. The end of the project, we had an interview, which was more us than the teachers. And that allowed us to pick up issues which we'd picked up during the diaries, you know, things we wanted to test out and say, when you said that, is that what you meant? So that allowed us to support our analysis as a roundup, if you like. So the interview had had different purposes before and after, but they were relational. And they're also reinforcing the validity of the analysis, if you like. And then also we had a survey which sort of fitted between the interview and the diary at the start, so like a pre-diary survey. And then we did it again after the diary and before the final interview, so the post-diary survey. And that was more quantitative, and really it focused on one concept of workload, which we'd looked to Rebecca Colley's work in Australia. She'd done some work where she broke workload and well-being into three different categories, which were all around teachers. One of those categories was workload well-being. And so we anticipate that actually whatever the workload was, and we wouldn't know what it was if we didn't do interviews and diaries, that might change over time, so we could compare it before and after in this diary period. And we did, you know, find some consistencies in that. Teachers were finding their relationships with their students were the really positive aspects of workload which contributed to their well-being. So no matter how hard it was, you know, the teachers were consistently before and after the diaries saying, actually, that's the sort of work they didn't mind. They got something positive out of. But things like administrative work and support from schools or the organizations they were working in, those were the things which could have been negatively contributing to the teachers' well-being, because they were sort of like burdens for them for all sorts of reasons. And so what the diary allowed was to give us some sort of sense to put to those quantitative outcomes. So we could say, you know, so what type of things were teachers doing, you know, with the students? What sort of relationships were they having? Or what sort of, what sort of school support were they getting? And so on, like, and things like that.
That's really, really helpful as well. Thank you for that. So it almost sounds like a sandwich method, where the diary was sandwiched in between these other methods.
Yeah.
Really interesting how the other method also supported you to be able to probe things and pick on things that had come out in the other method. So a really nice way of triangulating your approach.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about, I guess, the operational part of the diary? You mentioned the submission portal. How exactly did you operationalize the diary method in your work?
Yeah. We used, there was some software called Recollective, which is, I think, a Canadian software, which is often used by market researchers. So I'd not really come across it until we'd met up with some market researchers in another part of our organization. What it does, it allows you to build panels of groups of people who you want to test things out with or you want to ask questions of. And it works in a very iterative way. You know, if you put something into the software, then the other person will get an email alert or something like that. They can log in and then they can respond. So it sort of works in that world. I don't think I'd come across anybody using it for this type of research, of the idea of diarizing. What we found was a benefit was that, you know, everything was enclosed within one space. So when we've done online diaries or like email interviews in the past, you find yourself checking in and out of your email all of the time. And you know, it just disrupts things so much. So it meant that we could deal with our group of teachers at one period of time, and it was tidy in that respect. So whatever we put in there, they could all see. They couldn't see each other's submissions. So they could only see what we sent to them and we would get that back. But it meant that we could deal with everything from setting up interviews with them. You know, we could put that in the calendars. We could email them separately if we wanted to through the system. So it just meant it was very tidy. They would log in. They would have an account. All of the paperwork was in there. You know, the idea of the consent forms, the information sheets about the project. So everything was like tidily contained within that portal. We could see at a glance if, as we were getting towards a deadline of a 2-week period and someone hadn't submitted, we could see who hadn't. And we could gently prompt and say, if you're having a problem, that's fine. Let us know if you need an extra bit of time on this. And often some things are coming, you know, just a bit late. And teachers were very apologetic and they didn't need to be. But there was something about that relationship which we'd established, which I think was quite good there. And I think that it meant that almost the administration of the research was dealt with through this portal, through this software. And it didn't seem to diminish the relational aspects, which I think are so much a part of this approach, which is solicited diary, isn't it? It's not asking teachers just or anybody just to write down your stream of conscious thoughts. It's actually working in a two-way operation whereby we've got an agenda of certain things that we're interested in. So this is the field of play. They have an awful lot that they know about that, which they can share with us. And so it sort of keeps that sort of focused interaction together. And it allowed the administration of that to be quite, I sort of seamless from our point of view. And it didn't seem to shatter that relationship, which I was really pleased with. So that's how it worked. You know, they'd submit something every 2 weeks.
You just used the term solicited diaries. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah.
So it sounds like it was guided. You were asking them every 2 weeks to diarize about a particular topic or question. Yeah. Can you say a bit more about that?
Exactly. Yeah, the big difference between solicited and non-solicited is that I think what you get in a solicited diary, which is about prompted diaries or prompted reflection, is that you get this notion of reflexiveness built in. So the idea that, I mean, in fact, it's probably more about reactivity. Zoe Baker writes about this really well and influenced a lot of the thinking that I had on this. But the idea that any research method, I guess, where you're working with participants, you have reactivity. So you have an influence on the participant, you know, to varying degrees. One of the things about a non-solicited is where people write diaries for themselves. So actually, reactivity is, you know, a researcher is probably not in there at all. But it means that you'd have, if you're going to analyze those, you'd have to be ready for anything. And how do you get to the heart, the meaning of that? You know, it's like, who is that diary for? And it's probably for the person themselves. Solicited diaries are much more focused because they have an agenda, which is quite upfront. So the prompts themselves demarcate the areas of interest, which are shared. And therefore, I would say that the researcher is channeling the reactivity. They're actually making it very explicit and saying, actually, I want to use reactivity here. You know, I want you to respond back in these areas. And what I've found is when I've worked with other people in the past, where we've had a much more open agenda, even in interviews, they say, tell me about something. You realize your question's not good enough because they look shocked and a little bit surprised. It's like, I don't know what you mean. And that's where actually, in a sense, yeah, the reactivity is not working. You know, you actually are, there's too much space and there's too much space for anxiety. You know, you're burdening the participant with that of saying, because they think they should know what you want. And so I think what we were very clear about was using solicited diaries where we had a set of common prompts every week, which was like, how is it going? Have things changed in terms of what you teach? Are you teaching the things you'd intended to teach? So we'd have those sort of things which were sort of constant. How's your well-being? How are your students? But then we'd have things which would change over time. So in particular, we would ask about, you know, the grading guidance or whatever, because that came out halfway through. So how is that? You know, what does that make you feel? Or is it enough? And what's your reflection on it? So we were able to, you know, bespoke it to the environment at the time. So again, using that, provoking that reactivity so that we get something which for us was channeled and focused and helps our analysis in a way, because those are the questions we were interested in. So I think that's a big difference between solicited and non-solicited diaries.
Well, that's what I was just thinking as well, that it really depends on your research question, doesn't it? Yeah. Because your research questions were much more focused and you needed to be able to have those prompts to keep it manageable, really. Yeah. That's really helpful, because I think, I suppose diary is with any other method, there's just a whole spectrum of what you can do with it. So it's nice to get this perspective of the solicited diary and how you can do that and what it can elicit, really.
Yeah. And you know what? It's, even though it's solicited and you're setting the agenda, there's always space for them. What else? So, you know, the analysis has to cope with that as well, which is really exciting. So, you know, and I think that's, you know, we talked earlier about the wellbeing benefits. You know, the teachers getting things out. You know, we could get things where teachers would be, you know, off topic in a sense, our topic, but it's their topic and they want to say this. And, you know, that's probably why it works so well. You know, it helps to satisfy both us and the teachers as well, because they're sharing and unburdening things. So I think, yeah, solicited, but actually there's got to be a little bit of space for an openness. So we always had a thing at the bottom. Anything else you want to say? And then we thought we'll deal with that later.
I think that's interesting, because I was thinking about that as well, because you mentioned that teachers shared personal stories that you thought, well, they don't really know us. Why would they share these things with us? So that almost sounds like it's in contention with the prompts. But actually, I think, like you said, there's always room. And I think maybe what it does for you is, because you have those prompts, those personal stories are shared, the extent to which they relate to those prompts. So they're not just kind of shared gratuitously. No. So they're stories that are shared in as much as they influence the prompts.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
I so. And I think that's one of the great thing about using a solicited diary is that, you know, we're talking about well-being, we're talking about, you know, workload, you know, what's happening in schools, but actually teachers would then add the context to that. So say, actually, it's really hard at the minute. And it's hard because. And, you know, and that's where it becomes really powerful, because it brings a human element to what, you know, these phenomena are sort of like standalone abstract ideas, aren't they? You know, the idea of like workload and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But actually, by putting it in context of what it means for a person, it's like, you know, my mum's not well. That's really important. I need to share this with you because that's affecting the rest of my day and things like that. So, you know, I think that's why it's so powerful.
That's great. So that's been really, really helpful. We've gotten a great sense of the method that you use, how it related with the other methods and sort of where it existed within the trajectory of the methods that you used. Can you give us a sense of, you've talked a lot about the opportunities, and I don't know whether there are other opportunities of the method that you haven't spoken about, but can you give us a sense of the challenges of this particular method? And if there's another opportunity as well, you can mention it. But I think for someone who's thinking about adopting a diary method and considering a solicited diary method in the way that you've done, what would you recommend that the person think about? Obviously, your study was within a particular context. You had specific research questions. But what are some of the things that you would encourage someone to think about if they were thinking about using this method?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think before I go into challenges, I mean, I think the benefits would sort of overrode the challenges. So, and a couple of other things I would lift out really is the intuitive nature of a diary. It works in its favor. You know, you don't have to put in some heavy work about bringing someone into the method, in a sense, because, you know, it's the power is largely with the participant, and just recording ideas is a thing. And I think, but then I suppose there's an inbuilt challenge there, that who are you going to use it with? And is it easier to record, like we're doing now, rather than get people to write things down? You know, our people were very, very text, you know, sort of happy, so they could, you know, get things down in writing. And in a sense, I think that sort of supports their reflection, because they have a document. They have something documented, which is, you know, when you write things down, you often have an object which you can reflect on before you submit, because you often reread it or just check I've got it all right. I think when you speak, sometimes it's gone. Do you know? You've submitted in the moment, and you don't have that opportunity to get that second order reflection, which our teachers did. They talked about the transformational aspect of it, the idea of looking at what they were doing, taking a step back and saying, actually, I could do this better. So, you know, I think that's a real benefit, especially of text-based diarizing. I think some of the challenges, and the inevitable challenge, is recall error. So the idea of not being able to, or misplacing a memory, or, you know, just so much goes on, you can't necessarily capture it. And so what we capture is, I don't know, edited highlights. So what you've chosen to, you know, focus on. And so, you know, that is a real interesting thing to try and deal with, isn't it? How do we deal with that? I think the anxiety thing of working anywhere from a distance, you know, diarizing for somebody who's a long way away and who you have very infrequent interactions with, you know, I'm sure there must be an anxiety there about, am I doing the right thing? But hopefully we've supported them enough in setting that up. The big thing that comes through in diary studies is attrition. The idea that, you know, people give up. And I think that's the nature of any longitudinal study anyway. You know, it's always a risk, isn't it? But I think with diarizing, that's just, you know, adds to that. So, you know, how do you incentivize, or is there enough in it for people to say, actually, I'm really enjoying this, I'm going to keep going? So, you know, I think you've got to think about that. And not losing people and not overburdening and getting the balance right. So I think, you know, those aspects definitely need to be thought about when you're thinking about that. And then the final challenge I thought about was variance. So how do you deal with very, very different outcomes? Do you know, if you've got 15 people and they're saying 15 different things, you know, you've got to have a framework that allows you to make sense of that. And so I think, you know, you have to think through, you know, how in advance, what are we capturing here and how are we going to deal with that? Because that could be an overwhelming burden in terms of research or analysis. So I think, yeah, that's something. And your question about how would we advise, you know, anybody else setting these up? I think to get through all of those things, those challenges that I've just talked through, I think you've got to find an area of study or interest which matters enough to the participants. Because if it's something that you are have a shared interest in, that's a really important part of your relationship. And I think it helps to deal with things like attrition, you know, because it's like an ongoing relationship. You build and build and build. It has an iterative nature. And I just think it's finding those areas of study where there's an implicit trust so that, you know, participants are happy to share their very, very, you know, important and special insights with you about. So I think that's of, you know, it's finding that is your way into whether, you know, a diary might work. Or else it's otherwise it becomes a sort of, what do you call it, like a transmission sort of exercise, just communicating information. Do you know what I mean? And that, I think, is easy to drop. Easy to drop. If I was doing that, I would say, I can't see this through. So I think that's very important to think through. And just try and understand what it's like from the participant's perspective. You know, what are you asking of them? How much work actually is it? Because reflection is hard, isn't it? You know, when you ask people to think about their own life, and you might be encountering difficult things that you can't anticipate. So, you know, thinking about those things in advance is, I think, important. And I think all research is just about good relational work. It's setting up good relationships of trust and, you know, shared interest that everybody benefits from. So it's thinking that, you know, what are the participants benefiting from here by doing this? And I think that's worth thinking through as well.
That's really helpful. Thank you. And I take your point about the relationships. That's usually what I call research anyway.
Yeah.
The relationship, isn't it?
Yeah. It's so true.
It can be long or short,
yeah.
But it is ultimately a relationship.
It is. And, it is. It's like a conversation, isn't it? You know?
It's the efforts you make to build that relationship
that
really determine what it is that you do. And I really appreciate your point earlier about the different methods that you use. Actually, they weren't just triangulatory. They were helping you build that relationship with the way you embedded the interviews to develop that relationship, even though this was remote, I think was really, really important.
Yeah, you're so right. It wasn't an accident that the interview came first, I think.
That's great. Do you think, and we're coming to the end of the episode. Thank you so much. I think a question that I thought about earlier, and maybe in a way you've already addressed it, but this idea of scale, because you mentioned that you have 15 participants. And in a way, I think the sort of technology that you use or the software may have been able to deal with that. But what do you think about the idea of using this method at scale? Is it possible?
I think the analysis steers that conversation to some extent. It's like how deep do you want to interrogate the data? Because obviously there was two of us in this project, so me and Tori Coleman, my co-researcher. And so when we set out, had to really consider what can we deal with? Because we want to get into this data to be able to interrogate it as deeply as possible. So we want to explore the things like emotion, work, and things like that. I think there's probably technology now where you could gather loads. Do you know, you could have panels of people submitting stuff, and you could probably send some sort of data analysis software to pick out keywords. Do you know what I mean? There's probably ways of doing this on a massive scale. But what would you get from that? Do you know, it would lose the sort of the individuality and the human, you know, who the participants are. But you would get some very, very high level sort of like key indexes of certain things being, you know, sort of like flagged up. So, I think it wouldn't do it justice if you did it at a massive scale, because you'd lose that interpersonal relationship. I think that's what I'm saying there. So you could deal with it. I think technology could deal with it, but I don't think as an analytical tool, we'd be there in terms of really understanding what was being said. You know, I think we'd lose that aspect of relationship. So I think, I think it's how much resource have you got, isn't it? How many people on the other side are there to really interrogate it and come back and question it and pick it up?
Well, I was thinking in the context of, I guess, a policymaker, because of how important teachers were, as well as other key workers during this period. If they were interested in this, in trying to understand what teachers were going through, they might be interested in trying to apply this. And for them, then scale would become quite important.
You're so right.
That's what brought on that question.
It's a really good question. I think I think these types of studies tend to be complementary to other approaches in the end. And so I've seen this work now cited with other work, which is emerging, which is tending to use maybe more survey. So you've got the bigger picture. Saying, teach them that there's an awful lot of work. And then you need these almost like smaller studies to contextualize it and say, actually, well, what is that workload? And what are the impacts emotionally and so on? So I think, I reckon that's where these sort of studies come into their own, because they illuminate some of the bigger picture stories that are coming out with other methods. And there's an intuitive sensibleness about that. So, if you read the report, nothing's really surprising. I think that's what it's in a sense reassures people. It's a bit like, that actually explains, I understand this because it does relate to how I understand the experiences that people I know have gone through. So I think that's, it's sort of bringing those stories to the front, I think. And diaries are a good way of doing that, straight from the head of the people who are involved.
That's a great point about the way you can operate within a study that wanted to operate at scale, that it might not be the diary method you would want to scale, but it can support other methods that might be scalable. That's really, really helpful. Thank you so much, Martin. It's been excellent speaking with you. Thank you for all your insights about the diary method. I've certainly learned a lot.
Oh, thank you. It helped me a lot.
And I'm pretty sure those who will be listening to this would have learned a lot as well.
Thanks for the invite.
Thank you again. Brother.